The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's show, neighbors in Aceh, Indonesia, learn to trust each other again after the trauma of civil war. Plus, risky business, sailing a boat full of food to a floating market in the Caribbean.
La navegación.
When the engine breaks down and you don't find the solution, you stay drifted on the water, and then the ideas pops up of, are we going to make it this time?
And an aid worker battles bees in Bolivia.
I notice a crescendoing buzz. Dozens of bees had become hundreds, perhaps thousands. I'm not getting into that hive, I say, staring at the bees covering the dashboard, the seat, the wheel.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. Post-traumatic stress is something we often associate with soldiers returning from war. But survivors of conflict, even those who weren't involved in the fighting, sometimes suffer from psychological problems long after the fighting has ended. That's true in Aceh, Indonesia, where villagers are trying to recover from a long and brutal war between rebels and government troops. Jocelyn Ford reports.
5, 6, 8.
It's mid-morning, and a team of a half-dozen local counselors has just arrived in the village of Cute Girik. The village drummer calls the villagers to their community center. The team is here to lead a weekly group therapy session. Its aim is to help trauma survivors cope with the lingering effects of their ordeal. For 30 years, separatist guerrillas fought with Indonesian government troops. The rebels accused Jakarta of taking an unfair amount of their oil and gas wealth and of committing massive atrocities against their ethnic group. Often, villagers were caught in the middle. Some were victims of violence. Others, like Salbia, a heavy-set woman in her 50s, lost loved ones. Salbia says it happened early one morning several years ago when Indonesian soldiers confronted her son. They suspected he might be a rebel.
He was scared, and then he ran. He ran, and then they shoot him.
The villagers at Cute Girik have already attended several previous weekly sessions run by the group Doctors Without Borders Holland. At the first meeting, they shared their stories. It sounds like a simplistic cure. But during the long conflict, most families kept to themselves. They didn't know who was on whose side. American social worker Karen Stewart leads the team of local counselors here.
A lot of it is about reconnecting them with the other people in their community, in their village, to know that they're not alone, that other people are struggling with these symptoms, that these symptoms are a normal reaction, they are not crazy.
At today's session, several dozen women sit on the ground in circles, and counselors lead them in a concentration game. They write a number on the back of the person sitting next to them. She has to guess what it is.
A lot of them are very distracted. It's a very common symptom, yeah.
Salbia, the woman who lost her son, says she has occasional flashbacks, but she can get through each day. She enjoys the group sessions.
No, just happy because being together, not fear anymore.
But Stewart says when she and her group of local counselors first started offering the group sessions, villagers didn't think much of them.
It took a lot of education. The concept of mental health is not a familiar thing here. Some say we don't have time for mental health, we're working, you know. But others really get it. They really get that if my mental health is stable, then I can work better, I can care for my family better. I mean, they really understand it.
Some villagers, like 55-year-old Nursina, say they would rather not dig up old pain. Nursina lost her son and husband during the conflict. On this day, she is knee-deep in mud in a rice paddy, where she works for day wages. She swishes the seedlings in the water before planting them. Nursina has never been to a talk group, but she says she'd rather just move on with her life. Her religion, Islam, teaches her forgiveness. Nursina says, I'll give their lives to God, give to Allah what He wants. Stewart says consulting closely with local staff is the key to the program's success.
You ask them, what do you think? Is this something people can embrace and try? Or are we completely off base? You know, because, yeah, you don't want to come in here and set your own agenda. No.
Stewart adds, her group does not offer Western-style therapy to individual villagers. It could be harmful to encourage survivors to open up emotionally and then have the counselors leave after a few sessions. So her counselors focus on group activities, like the concentration exercises, and finally, a cooking contest.
Okay.
That's how Stewart's counselors end the nine-week sessions. The women form teams to compete for the best-tasting fried noodles.
So now we taste.
Yeah.
Stewart and the other counselors are judges. Everyone is awarded a pot or a pan or a drinking glass. For Stewart, it's the highlight of the sessions. She believes the small gifts can help the women move beyond their traumatic pasts.
2 months from now, when they are suddenly in an anxiety attack and panicked, and then maybe they look at this silly glass we gave them and they can think back, oh yeah, I remember that counselor, I remember the group. They see they're not alone, they're not forgotten. Yeah.
But for Stewart, today's cooking contest is a bittersweet occasion. Doctors Without Borders is ending its work in Aceh since the area is no longer considered an emergency. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jocelyn Ford in Aceh, Indonesia.
Doctors Without Borders is one of many humanitarian organizations offering aid in the developing world. Now, a group of students at Colorado State University is hoping to do the same thing using a business model. Carl Hammerdorfer is the director of the new master's program in Global Social and Sustainable Enterprise. He believes one of the best ways to alleviate poverty is to teach people how to start a business. It all started when he was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali.
When I went into Peace Corps, I had what I think is a typical sort of liberal arts-based bias against business. And that changed when I got to my village. And, you know, we wanted to find a way to dry mangoes, and that was a business problem. We wanted to find a way to help people produce more meat. We wanted people to make more money on agriculture. I was in Peace Corps with my wife. Almost everything we wanted to get done required a business solution.
Were you much of a businessman? Did you know how to help people there based on a business model?
No. I'd had a small coupon book business at college, you know, so I knew how to make a product and sell it when I needed money, but I didn't really know how you would take mangoes that were rotting on the ground in a small village in Mali, you know, process them in a way that you could bring them to market. I mean, there was a market for dried mangoes even back then in Western Europe and probably in the United States. I had no idea how you would build the business, how you might finance it.
So what you saw as a young Peace Corps volunteer was that a business model might work as well or better than some of the traditional development aid models.
I think so. I mean, I think Peace Corps is fantastic for what it does. You know, it gets mostly young Americans out there to understand foreign countries and to show foreign countries what Americans are really like. But given the great need for economic growth in these countries, and that's what it's all about, somebody's got to be paying more attention to working at the firm level with people who have small businesses that can grow into larger businesses. Because I think if you start an enterprise that is driven by the profits that it makes every week or every year, it's going to keep going because whoever owns it is making money off of it. And more often than not, they're employing people, and those people have jobs, they have money, they can buy better health care for their kids, they can perhaps add some electricity to their homes if that's what they need so the kids can read at night. A growing business provides more jobs for people. It's not that complicated, really.
And now, Carl, you're actually running a business degree program at Colorado State University where students in your program can get a degree in something called Global Social and Sustainable Enterprise. What does that mean?
What we'd like our students to do is work overseas and to build enterprises that make a profit, because they have to make a profit in order to be sustainable, to keep going. But we want them to also have a triple bottom line, which is a term much used now. It means basically that the business makes money, it has positive environmental effects, and positive social effects.
So what are you teaching your students that you wish you had known before you launched out with a group like the Peace Corps into the developing world?
Well, actually, I've come to love business. You know, I've done a 180 on it, and everything about it, the accounting, the finance, the marketing. So we're giving them that, and we're contextualizing it for the third world, for developing countries. So they're not going to learn how Coke would sell more product in Portugal. They might learn how Unilever changed their business model to sell soap in India to people who live at the base of the pyramid. Or they might learn how a company with a lower tech project is learning how to sell that in Honduras or West Africa.
I know your project's new and you're just getting to know this new group of students, but do any of them already have jobs or assignments planned that they're going to use the degree for?
In fact, many of them do. One of them is really interested in ecotourism. Another student who wants to clean up a place that he's referred to as the Black Ponds or the Black Lakes in Mexico, which are black because of the agricultural runoff and the human feces that goes into the rivers that feed it. Just a wide variety of students that want to solve a lot of these great problems and who recognize that they need some of the business discipline and the enterprise knowledge and the entrepreneurism if they want to succeed to achieve those things.
Carl Hammerdorfer, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Peggy, thanks for having me on. It's been great talking to you.
Carl Hammerdorfer is the director of Colorado State University's MBA program in Global Sustainable and Social Enterprise. He spoke to us from a studio in Greeley, Colorado. Aid workers in the developing world often face enormous challenges. Most are very human problems, like medical emergencies or armed conflict. But some challenges come from the natural world. Aid worker William Powers found this out when he spent time in the Bolivian Amazon.
I've really screwed up. I've driven our Jeep right into a gaping mud hole in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. We are 50 miles by dirt road from the nearest settlement. I spot fresh jaguar tracks 5 feet away and shudder. My friends, the three village chiefs, look at me with pity, but they don't complain. These are strong rainforest men. Heyman is a barrel-chested guy and slightly cocky. Sebastian is a bit plump around the middle, but hunts crocodiles. Gaspar, the smallest of the three, has a constant smirk on his face. They grab their machetes and get to work. I join them. As we slide felled logs under the tires, I shoo away a dozen honeybees. The bees have found us, I complain to Gaspar. The chief says cryptically, they will come. When we finally have the logs in place, I notice a crescendoing buzz. Dozens of bees had become hundreds, perhaps thousands. Now the bees have come, Gaspar says with a smile. I yelp with the first sting. I'm not getting into that hive, I say, staring at the bees covering the dashboard, the seat, the wheel. But the chiefs push me toward the truck. No one else can drive. There's no choice, they tell me. More bees will come. It will only get worse. The chiefs know that bees are searching for salt. The bees move away as I sit down in the driver's seat. But as I touch one of the Jeep's buttons, a bee stings my finger. I spring up, yelping and swatting, and receive 5 more stings. I run 50 yards from the truck, swatting all the while. Heyman, the stocky one, eventually catches up to me laughing. You screamed like a girl, he says. Gaspar runs over and says, the alarm lights are on. The battery will die, he exclaims. They both insist I must get back into the Jeep, turn off the alarm lights, and most importantly, get the pickup out of the mud. Gaspar changes tack. He puts a hand on my shoulder and says, you are a bee. He tells me that by tensing up, I was going against the bee energy and causing the insects to sting me. He was advising me to go with the flow. I walk back towards the dreaded pickup. As the buzzing builds, I repeat to myself, you are a bee, you are a bee. I gently shoo a bee away and slide the key into the ignition. The chiefs are in position around the pickup. I feel the chassis rising as additional logs are shoved under the spinning wheels. Meanwhile, a bee heads up my nostril. There's one in each ear. They perch on my eyelashes and eyebrows. You are a bee. You are a bee. And, to my shock, I had become a bee. Not a single sting now. All I feel is a light tickle from their little legs. I am fully relaxed, the communal buzz a gigantic om. Slowly, beautifully, the pickup rises out of the hole. The chiefs climb in, and we move forward through the Amazon, bees finding their way out of the windows, one by one.
William Powers is an aid worker and author of Whispering in the Giant's Ear, a frontline chronicle from Bolivia's war on globalization. It's not bees, it's mosquitoes that pose a problem in much of the developing world. Here's our globe at a glance. If you've ever had a mosquito buzzing around your head, you know how annoying that can be. But in many parts of the world, it's more than annoying. It can be deadly. More than 1 million people die each year of malaria, a mosquito-borne disease. It's mostly children who die of malaria, and most of them live in Africa. But there's good news about the effort to wipe out the killer disease. The World Bank has released a progress report on its program for malaria control. It says that a number of sub-Saharan countries are seeing a significant reduction in death and illness from the disease. That's because of widespread distribution of insecticide-treated mosquito nets and anti-malaria medication. The World Bank also announced a dramatic increase in its malaria funding so that it can meet its goal of cutting malaria deaths in Africa by 75% within 8 years. And that's our globe at a glance. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. José Rafael Rodríguez is a boatman, or barquero, from Venezuela. He travels to the tiny island of Curaçao to sell fruit, vegetables, and to fish from the edge of the dock. It's a pretty sight, this floating market, but behind the vibrant and colorful scene, there's another story, and one not quite so picturesque. Judith Ritter spent some time with the boatmen. She brings us this report.
It's about 6 in the morning here on the dock, and pretty quiet except for the sound of music from a couple of cracked plastic radios. More than a dozen boats are tied up here, old wooden crafts, some with peeling paint. To an untutored eye, they barely look seaworthy. As usual, the boatmen have been awake since 4 in the morning. They've taken improvised bucket showers on the deck and made coffee on small kerosene stoves caked with oil and food. The boats, about 18 to 20 feet long, are too small to sleep their crew of 5, so while some spend the night on the boat crammed in with the stacks of produce, others must sleep outdoors on the plywood sail stands. And that's where José Rafael Rodríguez spent the night. And now he's transforming his bed into his place of business. When he introduces himself to me, Rodríguez, who's in his 30s, takes a deep breath and puffs out his chest as if he's announcing his name proudly for his first communion.
José Rafael Rodríguez.
He's a lean man in a worn t-shirt, faded jeans, and the ubiquitous rubber flip-flops. He stacks and organizes piles of fruits and vegetables on the plywood rack in front of the boat.
Papaya, mango, banana, limón, coco.
Rodríguez, like all the men here, are from hardscrabble villages in Venezuela where it's almost impossible to find work. Although the life of a barquero, as these men are known, is difficult, José Rodríguez is grateful to have it.
Bueno, yo creo que más que duro.
We are doing it to survive. Where we come from, the economy is down, and then this is the only way we survive.
And he's not just concerned about his own survival. Rodríguez is one of 12 children, and as a barquero, he makes just enough money to keep himself, his younger siblings, and his elderly mom fed. But being away so long from his family is a hardship.
Vía celular, por carta, por el amigo que llega en otro barco semanal.
You're always worried how they are doing, haven't they eaten, are they sick?
While we speak, Rodríguez chops giant yams into smaller, more attractive pieces. There's no time to waste. People are arriving to shop. Other boatmen tend to customers while Rodriguez spends all morning keeping the counter stacked with produce that he heaves off the boat behind him. His t-shirt is dark with sweat. The sun gets higher, and Rodriguez gets hotter. While they're in Curacao on six-month visas, some men stay at the dock. Others keep the market supplied by running their rickety boats back and forth, picking up produce from Venezuela. It's a dangerous 35-mile trip that takes, at best, 18 hours. Because of the age of the boats and the roughness of the seas, accidents aren't uncommon, and lives have been lost. Men like Rodriguez live with trepidation on every trip.
La navegación es lo más duro.
We travel at night time, and that's the most dangerous part of the whole work. When the engine breaks down and you don't find the solution, you stay drifted on the water, and then the ideas pops up of, are we going to make it this time?
The 90-degree sun that was beating down on the barqueros all day is now low in the sky. It's cooler, and Jose is smiling.
He
says this was a good day, with good sales, and that means he'll eat this week, and so will his family. But Rodriguez knows he'll never get ahead doing this.
My dream is to have one day my own business, so I don't have to do the crossing and coming to Curacao.
In the meantime, it's friendship, and at the end of the day, a raucous game of dominoes that cushion this hard and dangerous way of life. For World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Curacao.
Small business owners in Mexico face quite a few obstacles to success. One of the biggest problems is the poor or non-existent phone service in some parts of the country. Telmex is the main telecom company in Mexico and one of the world's most profitable. It's quickly rolling out new technology to keep up with ever-increasing demand. Most of it goes to urban residents. Rural areas are all but ignored, making it difficult for small entrepreneurs to compete in this increasingly connected world. Conrad Fox brings us this report from the state of Veracruz.
Manuel Sanchez stands sweating in the midst of 30 beehives and a cloud of bees. He heaves a heavy wooden tray full of honeycombs from the top of one of the hives, working quickly to avoid annoying its occupants. He's still a beginner at this.
This is the first really good harvest. Last year was just practice.
When he was laid off last year from his job, he, his wife, and a group of farmers in the small community of Palma Real formed a cooperative and invested in the hives. He's one of a growing number of entrepreneurs in this region, many of them tired of the low profits in farming.
If you plant 15 acres of corn, you're working 6 days a week, and at the end, you harvest 10 tons of corn. Just 20,000 pesos. A ton of honey is worth 50,000. Now, the trick is to sell the honey.
But that is not going to be easy. These days, many businesses, even in Mexico, rely on a web page or an 800 number. In Palma Real, there isn't even a telephone. Emilio Facundo is a member of the Honeybee Cooperative. He says this is a big problem.
We've gone out to promote our honey, and people are like, where are you? How do I get in touch? Your honey might be really good, but if you live way out in some remote community with no communication, well, people are going to buy from a closer distributor.
Mexico suffers some of the worst disparities in telephone service in Latin America. In Mexico City and a few other urban areas, you can now get things like wireless internet and TV on your cell phone. But in some of the poorest regions, there are fewer than 5 telephone lines for every 100 households. Emilio Facundo explains why.
I once tried to get a line from Telmex, but they told me you have to have 200 families in the same community requesting one, and only 80 live here.
In fact, the phone company, Telmex, a monopoly in all but a handful of cities, is required by law to provide service in areas where 100 families request it. Critics say Telmex is not doing enough to provide service for the nation's rural poor. A Telmex spokesman refused to be interviewed for this story. This is the community store in the village of Pescador, a brisk half-hour walk from Palma Real. Pescador does have a phone system, sort of. Here's how it works.
Atención a este aviso. Se le comunica el señor Conrado Fox, que tiene llamada telefónica.
The single phone sits on the counter of the local community store. It's actually a cell phone with a large antenna mast planted out back. It was bought by the store owners, who charge you to make and receive calls. Say a call comes in for you. The caller hangs up, and the store announces your name on a loudspeaker. You leave your house or your field and go to the store and wait for the person to call back. That is, if the phone isn't already busy. For 5 years, Juana Hernandez ran her business selling handmade soaps and perfumes using this system. She says it was a nightmare.
If they call the store, the store isn't open all day. And sometimes they pass the message on, and sometimes they don't. And later the client asks us, where were you?
So last February, she spent $380 on a similar cell phone for herself. But she's not sure if it was worth the cost. With high rates even to receive a call, she estimates she spends about $80 a month on phone bills, about half her income. And, she says, the signal is so unreliable she still misses calls from clients. In a small workshop back in Palma Real, beekeeper Manuel Sanchez and his colleagues carefully strip honeycombs of their outer layer of wax, letting the thick golden liquid ooze out. With no telephone in Palma Real, how does he plan to compete with established companies?
Con señales de humo.
Smoke signals. Emilio and I are thinking about trying telepathy.
A new law passed by the Mexican Congress will soon bring more competition to Mexico's telephone market. But it's unclear if that will mean better service for the rural poor, or just high-tech extras, like more TV programs available for cell phones in the city. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Palma Real, Mexico.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Remember, you can hear us anytime on the web at worldvisionreport.org. And you can sign up for a podcast there and take us with you. Our radio team today includes Doug Boyle, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, and Diane Toomey. And I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.